dinner and talk it through. I want to go to the dorm. I would never hurt you. You know that. I want to go back to the dorm. Dot cried silently the whole way. Her mother probably thought she was angry. And she was, of course. But the tears were from loss, too. A story like that couldn't be unremembered. Eliza. I am quaking by the time I reach my parents' curb. My heart galumps, and I tumble out of the front seat and onto the sloped front lawn. The sky is a disarming shade of purple. Behind me, kids who have just climbed to the Hollywood sign are traipsing back to their cars. Their giggles sound like breaking glass. At the door now, once again, I smell the cloying scent of orange perfume. I roll back my shoulders, readying myself. I consider ringing the doorbell, but instead I try the knob. It twists easily, and then it whips open without me moving a muscle. I jump. Gabby blinks at me from inside, letting out an oof. Oh, I blurt. What are you doing here? Gabby's mouth twitches into a smile. She's wearing a black pantsuit and is carrying a red purse shaped like an anvil. I came home early. I was just about to come get you, in fact. Why? Your follow-up appointment, remember? Didn't I call you? I thought I was grabbing you at your house, but this is better. We'll get there much faster. I narrow my eyes. What follow-up appointment? For the pool thing. Remember, I said I'd take you? Is it for an MRI? I don't... She rummages in her bag and pulls out a reminder card. No, it's with someone named Dr. Schweitzer. Who's that? A psychiatrist. She says psychiatrist quickly, like I'll gloss over it, and smiles hopefully. I back away from the door. I don't need a shrink. Then Gabby notices my bruised face. What happened? Someone came up behind me and scared me, and I fell. What? I reach for the door to shut it. It's why I need to talk to Mom right now, actually. But, Eliza, the appointment. I'm not going. Gabby's hands curl against her chest. The crystals on the chandelier above the dining room table tinkle together. I didn't mean to yell that loudly. Look, I need to stay here. I temper my tone. I need to talk to Mom. It's really important. I'm not leaving until I do. She's not here. I shrug and plop down on the slipper chair near the door. Then I'll wait. Gabby checks her watch, then shuts the front door and walks closer to me. What do you need to talk to her about? She looks so dowdy in her baggy suit. People without style have always fascinated me. Is it that they don't care? Does she think she actually looks good? I made so much fun of her as a teenager, but Gabby was begging for it. She wore Mary Janes with socks well into middle school, for God's sake. And could she not have gotten cuter glasses? Now, of course, I regret it. If I'd been nicer to Gabby, perhaps she'd be a sympathetic ear now. I think Mom knows something she's not telling me, I explain. Gabby just stares at me for several ticks of the clock. Knows what? I saw her in this alley behind a parking lot a few days ago, sort of near her work. I think she was following me. I had a panic attack and passed out, and by the time I woke up, she was gone. I run my tongue over my teeth. She deleted something off my phone, then left. Though, I think she called the police to let them know I was back there. Nice of her, huh? Gabby looks astonished. Are you sure it was Mom? I think of the fuzzy image of her face that had returned to me at the steakhouse. Pretty sure. What did she find on your phone? Something important. And the only way she'd even know I found the important thing was if she was following me. Something really weird is going on, Gabby. I cut my gaze over to her. Do you know what it is? I don't have a clue. Gabby clears her throat. Look, you're going to hate me for saying this, but you sort of sound like how you sounded when you had the tumor. Always worried that someone was following you? That sort of thing. I know this sounds the same, but it's not. I have proof this time. What kind of proof? I remember Mom there, I urge emphatically. And I need to know why. My mind has been racing ever since I made the connection. Why would my mother delete the list of numbers on Leonidas's call screen? Is her number one of them? Is that the number I vaguely remember? It's possible. I would have recognized our home phone number. It's been the same since I was a kid. But I don't have my mom's cell memorized. So was my mother talking to Leonidas that day outside the cat show? Was she sharing some sort of worry about Palm Springs, and was he talking her down? But why? Because she's guilty of something, obviously. It's the only thing that makes sense. I look at Gabby. I think she knows who pushed me into the pool in Palm Springs. In fact, I'm sort of scared she pushed me into the pool in Palm Springs. Gabby smiles nervously. Okay, that's interesting, but just go with me here. Is it possible you're blaming Mom because she's the one who's the most worried about you? I burst out laughing. Mom hasn't even called me since Palm Springs. The only time she's spoken to me is to tell me that my book is crap. I wouldn't call that worried. She wants you to go back to the hospital. She's desperate for you to get better, and, Gabby, instead of waiting for me to regain consciousness, I interrupt. She ran off. She tampered with my phone, then left me in an alley. When the cops came, they thought I was nuts. But an unhealthy part of your brain is trying to fight against that. Gabby bulldozes over my words. You're not seeing things rationally. I mean, okay, even if Mom did run from you in a parking lot, clearly she knew you were okay. And you said yourself she called the cops just in case. Maybe she had a good reason to leave. My mouth drops open. What could that possibly be? Maybe she... Gabby shuts her mouth tightly and looks away. I feel a shiver down my spine. Maybe she what? I don't know. Maybe she was late for something. I can tell this isn't what Gabby was going to originally say, and I snort. Gabby walks across the room and looks out the window, her face hidden from view. Eliza, I know she's not all warm and fuzzy. Your illness has been hard on her. Some people rise to those occasions. Others, it tears them apart. They can't handle it. It kills them, and they just crumble. She sees you acting strangely again, and it's killing her. Are you trying to get me to feel bad for her? No, it's just that I don't think you see it from her perspective. None of us can wrap our minds about what you were going through when you were sick. Yeah, she should have been there for you a little more, but she does care. I woke up many times in the night to find her crying in the bathroom, or just down in the kitchen, sitting at the table, hands cupped around an empty coffee mug, just staring. I make a tsk sound. She always acted like she'd had enough of me. She's one of those people who doesn't know how to deal with tragedy, so she gets angry and distant. It isn't the right response, but it's just how she is. It doesn't change that she's hiding something. I'm still going to sit here until she gets back. Gabby looks at her watch again. I hate to break it to you, but I don't think she's going to be home for a while. She and Dad have some sort of dinner thing tonight. You'll be waiting a long time. She stands. So, how about that appointment? No appointment, I say. I'm not changing my mind. And then we stare at each other for a while. Okay, Gabby relents. We don't have to go to the appointment. But let's get out of the house. To get an early dinner, maybe. And then afterward, I'll bring you back here and we'll see if Mom is home then. Okay? I roll my jaw. It feels less satisfying, but I feel like if I say no, she'll try to force me down the appointment road again. And to be honest, maybe I haven't thought this through. I'm not sure if I'm ready for a confrontation with my mother. I want to ask her all sorts of questions, but she'll never admit what she's up to. She'll twist it somehow and turn it into my problem, my illness. This is all a figment of my messed up head. What I need is to prove it another way. I'm just not sure what that way is yet. Fine, I say. But you drive both of us. I'll leave my car here. That will force Gabby to bring me back, and maybe by then my mother will be home. Her car, a beige PT Cruiser, is parked in the driveway. The inside of it smells like a vanilla candle. The seats have recently been vacuumed, and the footwells are clear of the wrappers and napkins and books and other bullshit that plague mine. I kick open the glove box when I climb into the passenger seat. Her owner's manual is neatly stowed away. A plastic baggie labeled registration and insurance holds those two documents. I bet she's the type who regularly gets her tires rotated. I settle in the passenger seat, and Gabby swings next to me. There's a flash in the rearview mirror. A person is standing on the road, hands on hips, dark hair floating around her face. I turn around and viciously study the street behind us, but the road is empty. Sweat prickles on my body. It's that face again. My face. What? Gabby asks, staring at me. I look again, and of course the face is gone. Nothing, I say, trying not to sound breathless. I just thought, nothing. We start down the hill. I'm looking for a way into a conversation with Gabby, but I can't think of the right starting note. She sits very straight when she drives, like there's a book balanced on her head. Every few seconds, her phone buzzes with a text. I can see the bubbles appearing on her screen, then disappearing. Something else stings, too. Something in her purse. Do you need to get those? I ask. It's fine. I don't like to text and drive. When we turn onto Sunset, I sit up straighter. Are we going to the Chateau? The what? We whip past the Chateau Marmont without turning in. Undaunted, I point to Toy. That place makes good Thai cocktails, I sing out. Virgin cocktails, I mean. She continues past it, too. At the end of Sunset, she pulls into the valet lane and gets out, hefting her purse on her shoulder. I get out, too, my gaze on the below-knee hem of her skirt. Here on Sunset, she looks even more matronly. A tattooed man wearing short shorts and no shirt ambles up the street, yelling at someone on a cell phone. A convertible full of leering Asian guys cruises by, thumping rap music booming from their speakers. Across the street, a bunch of girls are wearing dresses that barely cover their crotches. Gabby's hair boings childishly. Gabby saunters past a bunch of rock clubs and boutique hotels and five-star restaurants and walks into a place called, at first glance, Gravel, though actually it's called Crave. Eat, heal, love, reads a large slogan over the window, and there's a picture of an enormous, fruit-filled smoothie. It's probably made out of pineapple, but the color reminds me of pus. Inside, tranquil music is playing, and people are sitting quietly at tables. The only jarring sound is a blender, juicing. A hostess, pin-thin with ripped Pilates arms, glides over to an empty table and hands us menus printed on paper so thin, I'm afraid just handling it will make it disappear. This place is nice, I mumble. I come here for dinner sometimes, Gabby says, with friends from work. Everything on the menu has quinoa in it, and there's not a single cocktail. Not that Gabby would allow me to get one anyway. I put the menu down and look around. There's a man in the corner who's got on the full Buddhist garb. He's sitting with the most beautiful woman I've ever seen, blonde and tan, totally flawless skin. I prefer bars with hard-looking women, jowly, fast-talking actors, chain-smoking rock and rollers. I suppose this is where everyone comes if they want to remain preserved. Gabby's phone pings again, and I chuckle. They keep you on your toes at work, huh? She checks it and places it face down on the table again. I suppose. So, how do you know so much about people's reactions to children with illness, anyway? Gabby gives me a strange look. What you said about Mom, I remind her. It was very insightful. She fiddles with her chopsticks. My boss's son has leukemia. I'm sort of dating him. My boss, I mean, Dave. Not Linus, his boy. That's great, Gabby. For how long? 6 months, 2 weeks, and 5 days. What's his son's prognosis? 50-50. Dave's a mess about it. I'm not sure we should be together right now. His whole focus is on his son, which it should be. But I guess he needs something else. A distraction. Something that makes him happy. Gabby primly sips her water. Maybe that's why Mom was so into kite surfing when you were sick. She needed an escape, too. Yes, but what a magical, picturesque escape, flying over the ocean on a kite. Is it terrible of me to wish she'd chosen a hobby that was a little gloomier? I guess I wanted you to suffer as much as I was, I say. No, but people show suffering in different ways. And in your case, in your mom's case, maybe you didn't see the extent of it. But I'm also not sure you're being fair to her. I sniff. And why would you say that? Because. Gabby looks away sharply. Red splotches appear on her cheeks. Well, you don't remember how it was. I sit back. What do you mean? Her mouth grows very small. A perfect little button. I've seen the look on her before, when we were teenagers and she once blurted out the word fuck at the dinner table. Something so old hat for me, but a word I didn't even know she knew. Let's just leave it at that, okay? Fury flares inside me. No, I'm not leaving it at that. What do you mean? People are hiding things from me, big things. I want to know what's really going on. When Gabby looks up again, her expression is strangely sad. Oh, Eliza. But before she can say anything else, her phone pings. She looks down at it, lowers her shoulders, and shuts her eyes. I need to get this. Stay here. She hurries off, snaking around the tables and pushing through the front door. She stands in front of the restaurant near a bike rack, head bent a little, her lips moving fast. I rake my hands through my hair. What are people keeping from me? What is it I'm not remembering? Is Gabby trying to tell me my hospital stay wasn't as I pictured? What was there to picture, though? And my mother really wasn't there. In fact, she texted me a picture of her on a kiteboard, floating above the Pacific, as though I should be proud of her and forgiving. Something pings in her bag. The same thing that's been pinging along with her texts. I ignore it at first, perusing the menu, flipping and flipping and still finding nothing I can imagine eating. There's a second ping, and then a third. Something is lighting up inside her bag. I shift my chair over and peek inside. It's an iPad. I don't even need to take it out to see that the texts from her phone have also shown up on the screen. Doing okay. It must be Dave, the boyfriend. I want to write to him to say he should make sure to sit with his son at the hospital, even through stupid moments, even when he's sleeping, because he really needs someone there. From one sick patient to another. And, oh yeah, don't lie to him. Don't cover shit up. It's not very much fun. There's another ping. When I look down, there's something in this text that I didn't notice on the first one. A name is attached. For a moment, my brain doesn't make sense of it, and I assume that it's only what I want to see, simply because I've been too much in my own world lately, too engulfed in my own problems. So I look again. And one more time, because it's not a name you see very fucking often. Leonidas. I read the second text, The cops haven't called you, have they? My heart goes still. Outside, Gabby is still talking on the phone. She probably hasn't checked the texts that have come in yet, and I'm guessing they show up on this device and her phone simultaneously. Her back is to me, so I slide the iPad from her bag. I stare at Leonidas's name in the bubble. And then something else flashes to me, hot and flinty in my mind. That's why one of the numbers on the screenshot I'd gotten of Leo's call screen seemed familiar. It was Gabby's. He'd been talking to Gabby. About me. I try to remember what I'd overheard Leo saying at the cat show.
I mean, why would they ask you? And you don't need to bring up Eliza or Palm Springs.
Another text pings in. Leonidas again. If they do, remember what we talked about, it reads. Just stay the course. I grip the iPad tightly, wishing I could type something, but knowing that as soon as I swipe the screen, a password request will come up and those texts will disappear. I stare at the words, willing for more to come up. Anything to explain this. A shadow falls over me, and I jump. Gabby has her phone in one hand. The text's clear on that screen, too. She stares at her open bag, and my fingers wrapped around her iPad. When I meet her gaze, her expression is eerily calm. Not caught. Not frantic. Not bumbling. Not scrambling. It is as though she was expecting this might happen. And as though she formed a plan in case it did. Gabby, I whisper. She grabs the tablet from me, whirls around, and runs. Gabby! I call out, bursting onto the street. Gabby, wait! Gabby is scrambling in her suit and heels, her purse bouncing against her back. She banks around a corner, sweeping right past her parked car. Gabby! I cry, chasing after her up the long street. She keeps running. Gabby! I scream, stop! I need to talk to you! Just go, Eliza! She calls over her shoulder. Please! I'm not leaving! Not until you tell me what the fuck is going on! She's run into an alleyway, and there's no way out. She halts and spins around, shielding her hands against her chest. She looks frightened of me. Which is ridiculous because it should be the opposite. Right now, I have no idea who I should be afraid of. Maybe everyone. Tell me why Leonidas is texting you about the police, I demand.
It's all a misunderstanding.
Bullshit.
Just let it go.
I'm not letting it go. You know something, just like Mom knows something. How do you even know Leonidas?
We've been friends for a while, out of worry for you.
Why is everyone so worried? This last word explodes off my tongue. Salty. Fizzling. Gabby's bottom lip twitches. She's digging her thumbnail deeply into her palm. Why are you and Leonidas talking about Palm Springs? I press. Why is he talking about the police? What are you guys trying to cover up? Gabby juts her chin toward the sky.
Eliza, this isn't some kind of conspiracy.
Really?
You could have fooled me.
The blinking neon lights on the hotel across the street are only enhancing my dizziness. I turn away from them. I know you have answers, so you'd better start talking. What are you keeping from me? Tell me what you know. I'm inches from her face now, my breath mingling with hers. Gabby tucks her chin into her chest. Her shoulders heave up and down.
Eliza,
she squeaks.
Trying to figure out the pool thing, you're just harming yourself. It's making you so paranoid. So troubled, like before. We're not trying to hurt you. We're not the bad guys. You're sick. Whatever was happening to you before your brain incident, it's happening again.
There's part of me that wants to buy into what she's saying. After all, I think it might be true, too. But I keep seeing those texts on the iPad screen. No, this isn't just my brain. Not all of it. I'm not just randomly falling into pools. And I heard Leonidas saying something sketchy on the phone the other day.
And I remember Mom in that parking lot. I know you know something. Maybe everything.
You can be arrested for withholding evidence, I warn her. You know that, right? If you know something, you have to tell me. I can go to the police.
Her eyes are shut. Don't go to the police.
Because that would get you in trouble, right?
Just let it go.
Her hands flail in front of her face.
I can't, I scream.
I back away from her, my whole body heaving. I don't realize I'm crying until the tears hit my mouth. We both stand there for a few beats, hardened in our shells. After several ragged breaths, Gabby looks at me again. Her eyes are dark and wet.
It was me, Eliza. I did it.
My hands fall to my sides. A garbage truck passes by, and I concentrate on that for a moment, staring at the red plastic string of a trash bag that got caught outside the hopper. I try to imagine what could be in that trash bag. Porn magazines, yogurt containers, body parts. When I turn back to Gabby, her head is dipped so low I can see her straight, neat part. What did you do? I whisper.
I was at a conference at the Tranquility the same day as you. It was a weird coincidence to see you there. You were in the bar, and you were acting so strangely, like you were going to have another seizure. I tried to calm you down, but you got violent with me. I realized you were really, really drunk. So I walked you outside to get some air. But you kept freaking out. You were just so drunk, and you were acting so ridiculous. And I was afraid you'd say...
She takes a big breath.
I wanted to sober you up. I wanted you to just... rest. So I pushed you in the pool. It was a knee-jerk reaction.
Gabby peeks at me.
I'm sorry. I am so, so sorry.
I was talking to you at the bar? I try out, digging around in my brain. I wish I could remember this. I wish I could remember her.
Yes, that's right.
Her syllables come out choppily, like she's pulling them, taffy-like, from her throat.
But then I walked you outside. I just didn't want you making a spectacle of yourself. I was trying to do you a favor, but I realize now that it was a terrible decision.
What was I freaking out about?
I don't really know. I couldn't understand you.
So you pushed me into a pool just because I was being drunk and ridiculous? When you knew I couldn't swim?
I know. It's awful. I wasn't thinking.
She covers her face with her hands. Is it because of what happened when we were young? Her head shoots up.
What?
How I wasn't nice. The vodka thing. And when I put you in the closet. And the time you needed stitches and never told on me. Gabby places a hand to her mouth.
Oh, God, Eliza, no.
I choose to believe her, because she looks honestly confused. Okay, but why push me into the pool? Jesus, Gabby, if you wanted to sober me up, you could have shoved me down an elevator bank or thrown me in a fire. At least people wouldn't have immediately assumed I did it to myself.
I wasn't trying to frame you. It just happened. You were standing by the pool, practically ready to dive in yourself, so...
And then you just left? I'm still so stunned. I really, really didn't think Gabby was capable of this sort of thing. Her eyes dart back and forth.
I was about to dive in after you, but then I heard someone coming, so I took off.
She tilts her head up to the pinkish sky.
I shouldn't have. I was freaked out about it the whole night. I was ready to say something the next morning at the hospital because I thought they'd have the whole thing on camera and figure it out anyway. But then I found out that the
security cameras were out because of the storm. I finish for her. Gabby nods.
Right. Still, I should have said something. I know how it looked. Only by then you were saying someone was trying to kill you. And that's not what I was trying to do. And then that guy who works with the police came, which never happened before because it always was so clearly a suicide attempt. And then...
She puffs her eyes and blows out a breath.
I'm awful. I know. I let everyone believe you were trying to kill yourself. And you weren't.
I know I wasn't. I say this wearily, though, not triumphantly. I wish I were feeling something grandiose right now. I've solved it. But I just feel numb. This doesn't solve everything, after all. It doesn't solve the piece about me being completely and totally healed. It doesn't make up for the memories I've forgotten. So Mom knows about this too, I guess. That's why she tracked me down in the alley and deleted the picture off my phone. She nods sheepishly.
We were on alert after you mentioned Leonidas last week. He knows about what happened in Palm Springs, too. It was me he was talking to on the phone that day you overheard him. But we didn't think you were going to actually confront him. But then Leonidas called Mom to say something strange happened at his office. Some guy tripped and made a big scene. And when Leonidas came back to his desk, his phone had been moved. Something felt off, he said. He had a weird feeling you'd just been there.
I grit my teeth. I knew Desmond shouldn't have been so histrionic. And had I really been that obvious?
So Mom walked over from her office to see if you were in the area. And you were. She found you in the alley. She didn't intend to scare you, Eliza. She just wanted to talk to you.
But instead, she deleted a screenshot of his phone with your number on it. She was trying to protect your needs over my sanity. I sniff. She always did favor you over me.
Don't be silly.
Gabby looks embarrassed.
We were worried that you finding out I was involved might make you even more paranoid. But you have to understand, I was trying to help you that night in Palm Springs. You might not have tried to kill yourself, but you were still out of control that night. Self-destructive. You're supposed to be taking care of yourself. You do need the help Mom keeps recommending.
You know, for someone you were afraid was paranoid, this definitely isn't the way to help them, by making them feel even more paranoid.
I know.
Gabby's head hangs low.
I realize that now.
And you didn't 5 minutes ago, when you were telling me how sick I was? When you were saying I sound like I did before the tumor? I put my hands on my hips. It's not fair.
I know,
Gabby says, kicking at a pebble.
I'm sorry.
Someone has inscribed his or her name into the sidewalk. It looks like either Anna or Anne. Anger broils in my stomach, and at the same time, my heart is broken. I picture all of them sitting in the hospital waiting room in Palm Springs before I woke up, concocting this plan. Okay, so we'll just say that she did it to herself, even though she didn't. It's clear she's still messed up, and it's best to just send her off again, right? Yes, right. Okay, break. On one hand, I feel oddly comforted by the fact that I have a family who cares enough to concoct complicated scenarios to help me. On the other, it's hurtful that they thought I was so gullible that I just buy into the idea that I was crazy without asking questions. They don't know me at all. They don't understand me at all. Gabby is quietly crying. I cross my arms over my chest, trying not to care.
I love you, Eliza,
she says.
I truly think of you as a sister. I've always cared about you. Even when you've been a difficult person to care about. But I get it if you hate me. And if this happened to me, if I fell into a pool and woke up and had people telling me I'd done it on purpose, I'd be clamoring for answers too. Mom and Dad are going to be furious I came clean with you. But I'm glad I did. Now maybe you can drop it. Now maybe you can just live your life. Be happy.
Be happy, I spit out. Poof. Just like that.
It's all any of us want for you. Just to live your life. To not be scared. To not be sick.
She steps a little closer to me. I can smell something coming off her pores. Soap and sweat.
Are you going to tell the police? They've asked me a few questions. They know I was there. I haven't told them what really happened, though. I guess that's in your hands now.
I think of all those calls to the tip line, all those unanswered messages, all the hours I've spent obsessing over this. All this time, Gabby was lying to me. It makes my head pound. But I also think of the MRI that's scheduled. I can buy that I was drinking at the Tranquility because there was something wrong again in my head. I can also buy that the paranoid feelings rushed back too. Symptoms of the tumor. Maybe I fell into a death spiral of self-loathing. Maybe I began to think someone was after me. I consider my bike ride in Santa Monica again. That day, I'd been so overcome with the certainty that someone was pursuing me on a bike, and I'd become so afraid I'd hurtled into the ocean. I remember standing on the pool's edge at the Tranquility, gripped with the same sort of fear. It's not improbable to believe my family's been right all along. Maybe it is happening again. And maybe, in a backward way, Gabby pushing me into the water is her way of calling it to my attention, and my family's attention, so that I can get the help I need. I clear my throat. Part of me wants to say that, yes, I'm going to tell the cops. I've been manipulated after all, lied to. But part of me just feels tired. I do want it to be over. I'm sick of being angry and paranoid. No, I say. It's fine. Her face opens like a flower.
Really?
She throws her arms around me and hugs tight. We stand there for a while, in the middle of sunset, rocking back and forth.
I'm sorry,
Gabby keeps saying.
I just want you to be better.
I think she means to say happy, but is too distraught to realize her mistake. We break apart. Gabby insists on driving me back to the house. But all at once, there's somewhere I want to go. And I don't want to waste the time stuck in traffic just to get my car. I can pick it up tomorrow. I've done all right without it for this long, after all. I feel scooped out and ravaged, betrayed and shocked, but also calmer than I felt in weeks. Gabby is right. Maybe I do need to find happiness. Or at least something to distract me from the pain. Just like how her boss is dating her so he doesn't have to think about his sick child every moment of the day. I suppose that's all anyone can do. Though it's not something I'd indulged in. Instead, I've been crouching and shrieking and panicking at every turn. My whole life one big anxiety attack. Maybe that's no way to live. After I get inside the Uber, I give the Westwood address of the apartment building I've looked up online several times since Desmond told it to me. When I get there and peer into the lighted windows, I spy Desmond pacing back and forth in the front window, talking to someone out of view. It's like in the movies. When I ring the buzzer on the street, I see him stop through the glass and peek out the curtain. His expression is startled for a moment when he sees me, and then he mouths something into the phone and disappears from view. And then there he is, in the lobby, flinging the front door open, his smile surprised and pleased. And I fall into his arms, deciding that my happiness, my real life, hopefully full of love and joy and truth, starts right now. Eliza. Desmond likes Eggos for breakfast. Blueberry, specifically, with Mrs. Butterworth syrup. And when he handles the bottle, he speaks to Mrs. Butterworth with deference and is very careful not to touch her plastic breasts. He sleeps in his socks, and if even a day goes by without shaving, He has dark stubble that makes a sandpaper sound when you rub it with your palm. I got him to shave off the Guy Fawkes facial hair, and already he looks much better. His lips are full and sensuous. I have no idea why he was hiding them. I catch him glancing at himself in the mirror, though, rubbing his smooth upper lip and chin in lament. But I choose to ignore it. I'm working on him getting a haircut next, but when I delicately mentioned that he could use a trim, he looked horrified and backed away from me, pulling his hair into a hat, as though he thought I might set it on fire then and there. He sleeps in a bedroom full of light, in a big, well-made bed with a tufted headboard. I am told it's his parents' bedroom. They're both ambassadors and rarely home. The apartment has a lot of leather chairs and fiddly French cabinets, courtesy of his parents. But some of the design elements are of his choosing, like the bowls of potpourri on the high shelf. When I'm alone in the room with it, I take the strange dried fruit pieces out of the bowls one by one, trying to crush them between my fingers, but they won't yield. There is a jar of sea breeze on the vanity. His shower curtain has tiny printed sailboats, which were so incongruous to his being they made me laugh. "Oh, my brother Stefan hung that," he says. I meet Stefan, his brother the dabbler, a portly guy with kinky hair to his waist and huge nostrils. He looks nothing like Desmond, though apparently they are biologically related. Stefan wears stained t-shirts and wrinkled khakis, and carries around a jug full of whole milk that he slowly drains through the course of a day. In the little hallway just outside the kitchen is a cabinet full of Desmond's authentic absinthe collection and a bunch of vintage absinthe spoons. He keeps the cabinet locked because, he says, one time Stefan got in there and drank a whole bottle and almost died. "You don't cross wormwood," he says spookily. "It has a majestic power over all of us." His windows look out onto a courtyard with a Roman fountain filled with pennies and dimes. He has an owl sculpture made out of tin on his mantle. If it were to fall, its beak would impale a toe. Over the couch is an afghan his aunt knitted for his parents when they got married. He tells me these things on days 2 and 3, as we drink coffee, as we rub each other's feet, as we kiss and kiss and kiss. His mouth so big and different, his movements surprisingly sure, his body engulfing mine in bed, despite its smallness everywhere else. He admits he writes poetry. I tell him about Kiki's awful sonnets. Together, we look through his high school yearbook. He looked like Guy Fawkes even then, and was even skinnier. We cook dinners together, weird gourmet things that involve cheesecloth and double boiling and cauldrons. One of the nice things about living in an apartment actually owned by 50-year-olds is that they have nice cookware. On day 2 of our courtship, Desmond builds a special shelf for my vitamins, and I move them in. We read from a book of epigraphs from 15th-century tombstones. We put on Halloween masks, a gorilla and a pug, from Stefan's closet, and sit on the balcony, waiting for people to notice us. The masks smell organic, like skin and dairy. The smell of sour milk leaks out of Stefan's pores. Desmond shows me a layout for the next Comic-Con and explains the new exhibits and the big draws. I pretend to be interested, but mostly I'm just disappointed nothing like the Adams family will be there. I talk to him about my time in the hospital. Desmond listens, and he adores. I wake up some mornings and he's just staring at me, starry-eyed. He stands close to me in the elevator. He sneaks his hand up my skirt whenever people's backs are turned, and sometimes even when they're not. When we go out for dinner, I feel his fingers tickling my thigh, and I jokingly swat him away. I find his woolly eyebrows strangely sensuous to lick. He buys me an Addams Family cartoon book from the 1940s, and together we look through it, marveling over the artwork. On our second Saturday together, I'm sitting on the couch, looking at my cell phone, daring myself to open a review of The Dots. More people have read The Galleys, and the opinions were starting to trickle in. "They're good," Posey told me. "You really should read one." But I'm not sure I'm brave enough yet. Desmond is in the shower, preparing for work,
And while I'm staring at my phone, wondering if I can do it, Stefan lumbers into the living room with his JanSport backpack and his jug of milk. I've been told that this week he is working as a production assistant on a cable channel zombie show, though other weeks he works in lighting or sound or even at the commissary, making tacos. Stefan doesn't limit himself to Hollywood stuff either, Desmond explained. Last year, he took a job as a trumpet player on a cruise ship and was gone for 6 months. Before that, he aided a veterinarian who specialized in giant, exotic, illegal Hollywood pets, like white Bengal tigers. Some big-time director had a rhinoceros in his backyard, and Stefan helped it give birth. Stefan plops down on the couch opposite me and pushes his dirty watercolored hair behind his ear.
You're nice, he says, looking at me carefully.
I give him a guarded half-smile and glance toward the shower door, hoping Desmond finishes up soon. Thanks.
No, I'm serious. My brother's a fucking freak. We all know it. He knows it. But you're nice. You seem to get him. You're way nicer than Paul.
Paul. I know that name. After a moment, I remember why. Paul, the guy from work? The guy who was there when I drowned.
Paul's a girl. It's short for Paula.
Stefan peers into his backpack, gives me a mysterious look, rearranges something in there, then zips it up.
They had a thing for a while. Dez took it hard when it ended. He seems better now.
Then he stands and shoulders the backpack. His feet are dinosaur heavy as he plods toward the door, and before he steps into the hall, he jabs his finger toward my forehead.
So don't wound him, okay? I'll have to hurt you.
The door closes, and I stare at the god's eye someone has hung on the knob. I feel slimy and sour, like Stefan has coated milk on my face. Is it because Paul, my co-rescuer, is a girl, and Desmond's ex? Hadn't Desmond deliberately hinted that Paul was a guy, though? Does he still see Paul? Do they work together? I curse Desmond for not having a cell phone. It's so hard to spy on him. I stop myself mid-thought. I'm being dramatic, creating problems where there aren't any. So what if Desmond lied about Paul? He didn't want me to assume he was attached. And Stefan was giving me a compliment, as backhanded as it was. I have cured Desmond of his misery. I understand Desmond, and that's something to be celebrated. Of course, worrying like this doesn't mean I love Desmond. Not yet. But maybe I will. Eventually. We're on our way to becoming two peas in a pod. We're on our way to finishing each other's sentences. Now where have I heard that before? It's MRI day, finally. I feel like I've been waiting for years. I need someone to accompany me in case I have a bad reaction from the injectable dye, but I can't imagine asking anyone in my family. I don't want to give them the satisfaction of admitting I too believe I'm sick again. I'm not sure they even know that I know the truth about the pool. I doubt Gabby had the balls to tell them. Really, I should call my mother and tell her what I know, and that I'm never speaking to her again, for a lot of reasons. But maybe it's not worth it. She'll just say they lied for my own good. And she'll have an explanation for the incident in the parking lot, too. She'll say she was trying to protect me. She'll say whatever bullshit she needs to. I want to bring Desmond to the appointment, but it's crunch time at the convention, and he can't take the time off. So I ask Kiki. I have to tell her everything, all the truths I've kept hidden. And I expect her to panic, but instead, she receives it with calm. It fills in some holes, she tells me. Now I understand why you're you. Now I understand why you don't remember going to yoga. I didn't go to yoga that time, I argue with her, but then stop myself. Maybe I did go to yoga. Maybe it didn't matter that I didn't remember. We meet at my house before the appointment. The inside seems unfamiliar when I walk in, and then I realize why. It's clean. There isn't any dust on the theremin,
The baseboards don't even have a layer of grime. The place no longer smells like a dying horse. Kiki's in the kitchen drinking a glass of lemonade. She's in the same rainbow skirt she wore when she met me at the writing group, and her hair is tied back with a yellow ribbon. She looks scrubbed. Young. I had 3 Elsa parties yesterday, she then grumbles, sinking into a seat at the table. It's been a nightmare. Then she peers at me. It's lonely without you in the house. I didn't mean to stay away this long, I tell her. I would like to offer for Desmond to stay here, but the idea of him having a run-in with Stedman nauseates me. It's bad enough I've had to cross paths with him 4 times at the curiosity shop. Kiki doesn't ask why we haven't come to the house either. She probably knows. So, what's Desmond like? Kiki leans forward, fluttering her lashes. He's so handsome. My mouth drops open. You think? Of course, don't you? He's so swashbuckling. Definitely a step up from Leonidas. Leonidas wasn't that bad, I mumble. Not that I really know. Thinking about him still freaks me out. I don't like that there are so many blank spaces in my memory about him, but I've decided to think it's a minor blip. A boyfriend obliterated by lack of brain function. I have to believe Leonidas is a good person, a person who worries about me, just like Gabby. I hate, though, that he was in on the whole who pushed Eliza ruse. I still get the crawling feeling that they're all snickering behind my back, or else covertly filling out the forms to send me to the Oaks. But Desmond is... I search for adjectives for Kiki, and all at once there are too few and too many. Lovely. I tell her about his role at the convention and his place in Westwood. I describe the dates we've been on, real dates where he shows up with flowers and holds the door for me. I thought I wouldn't be into that sort of thing, but it's quite charming. He even bought me a gift, I say. A 19th century baby carriage and 2 of the scariest Cupid dolls you've ever seen. Kiki grins. Classic. She leans closer. That said, you need to hold on to him. You need to be careful. I frown. How so? She fiddles with her straw. Don't go out as much. What are you talking about? She studies me carefully. Stedman saw you at this club he likes. Cosmos, I think. You were talking to some guy. I give her a crooked, incredulous smile. That's impossible. That's what I said, but he was sure it was you. Just watch it, okay? He said Cosmos has this website where they take pictures of the crowd. Don't get snapped in one. I'd hate for Desmond to find out. Kiki, there's nothing to find out. I haven't been to any of those places. Kiki looks at me carefully. I can tell what she's thinking. How do you really know, Eliza, if you can't remember everything else? But I have a witness. Desmond can vouch for where I've been every night, because every night I've been with him. Except for the few nights where he's had a conference emergency. But even then, I'd hung back at the apartment and watched TV. A doorman could corroborate my whereabouts. Or Stefan. Right? At the imaging center, an assistant smiles at me and hands me a form to fill out. I list that a year ago, I'd been at UCLA for surgery. I list my doctor, Dr. Forney, and his address and phone. Kiki checks her phone while we wait. After its battery dies, we pass the time watching Rachel Ray force her guest, some actress I've never heard of, make duck ragu with her. There's a lot of fake laughter that makes me feel jittery. They call my name, and I walk through the door and into a long hall. In a small room, I change into a gown and lie down on the table. They start the IV of dye, which warms my body slightly but otherwise feels like nothing. After a few minutes, I'm led into another room where they slide me into the long, dark metal tube, the walls closing around me. I wince at the ear-splitting sounds of machinery and play Beethoven's 9th loudly in my head. The lyrics and melody of a 311 song I may have listened to with Leonidas come back to me in a rush,
and I let the whole thing play out, realizing I know every word. I feel an itch coming on, and I'm about to scratch it when I hear a voice. "Don't scratch. They'll be mad at you. They'll sequester you to the ICU for this." My eyes open wide inside the tube. The clicking sounds of the MRI machine rush back, loud and urgent, as though I've woken from a dream. The ICU. But I was never there. Dot was, as a child. So why was the memory so vivid? Why did I suddenly and distinctly remember the pull in my chest as a nurse pushed my wheelchair down the hall? Where was I going? Is it just a dream? I follow the memory to its end. I remember glancing at my face in a mirror as we passed. There's a child staring back. 8, 9 years old. A knockoff Wednesday Addams. But it's my eyes. My face. Only there's no way. I wasn't in a wheelchair at 9. Was I? Count backward from 10. The banging sound stops, and the silence is ear-splitting. Slowly, the tube moves, ejecting me. I blink in the beady overhead lights. The nurse smiles above me. "We're all done. You do okay in there?" "Yes," I think I say. I feel my arms, my legs, and my stomach to make sure they're still intact. I want my body to feel different, smaller, lighter, more slippery, like that of an arachnid that's just fumbled out of its egg, blind and ignorant to the world into which it's just been thrown. But it's just the same old me. It's Sunday. I am lying on Desmond's bed, my ear against his stomach. It is dusk. Lavender light has cloaked the room. I can hear the gurgle of his digestive juices. I can also hear him turning the pages. I am letting him read the dots. It's time. The book comes out in 2 days. He is focusing so intently on the page, it's as if he is turning each of the words upside down and shaking them for change. I want to get up and go somewhere else. It is torture lying here, watching him read, trying to gauge what he's thinking. And yet, I cannot move. I can't go into another room and pretend to occupy my thoughts. I want to know immediately, the very moment he finishes. Finally, he marks a page, closes the book with a slap, and looks at me. "Well." "Well?" I practically shriek. "That's all you can say? Well?" "Well," he runs his hand over his hair. "It's exigent. Like a pandemic." "Is that bad?" He gathers me in his arms. "Of course not. That's good. I'm not quite at the end," he adds. "But I feel like it's going to be tragic." I nod. He is right. "But in an apropos way. Shakespearean, yes?" "Don't compare me to Shakespeare." I let out a sigh. "So why does my mother hate it? Did I make the mother too unyielding? Too much of a bitch?" "It's definitely raw. But she's not that bad. I mean, she's sort of absent. She's sort of angry, but she clearly cares." "So why did my mother get so offended?" "I guess it hit too close to home for her." He scratches his chin. "Roxanne's going to ask you that, you know. How your family is taking it, if you have any regrets." I nod. "Dr. Roxanne is in 2 days, and I'm no less anxious about it. I'm afraid she's going to ask cutting questions, or I'm afraid she's going to say to her live audience that she didn't like the book. I'm afraid of explaining why I wrote it. It's a stupid concept, surely, a girl with a brain tumor who has a crazy aunt. The only reason it's getting buzz is because I made a fool of myself being pushed into a pool." Desmond seems to sense my panic and clutches my hands. "You don't have to go on the show, you know. Seriously. I'll still think you're the most amazing vixen ever, even if you don't. Don't let the people you work with push you around. Do this on your own terms." Posey would kill me. Laura already said that if I did,
She'd probably never sign me for another book. But I thought you didn't want to write another book.
I probably don't, but I at least want the opportunity.